This episode is brought to you by Taproot Edmonton, which publishes curiosity-driven stories, topical newsletters, and locally focused podcasts, all in the service of informing Edmontonians about their community. Want to start your day informed? Check out The Pulse, Taproot's new daily news briefing. The Pulse tells you what you need to know about Edmonton every weekday morning. You'll get short, informative updates about what's happening at City Hall, plus coverage of business, tech, food, the arts, and more. You'll also get a bit of whimsy from features such as A Moment in History, Chart of the Week, and the Friday Podcast Pick. And it's free. Sign up today at taprootedmonton.ca/pulse. That's taprootedmonton.ca/pulse. Hello, Stephanie Wolf.
Hello, Karen Johnson Diamond. Welcome to your podcast.
And your podcast. Want to share?
Yeah.
Called Scam Time.
Scam Time? What's that about?
Well, as you have been known to say, it's about scams and the times they have.
They never are on holidays. Scams just work overtime.
All those scams standing around the water cooler going, good times, good times.
Guess who we ripped off today? High five, scammy.
Hey, I would like to read you a tweet that has absolutely nothing to do with scams.
Perfect.
This is a tweet that has been written to Jody Gondek.
Oh, your new mayor.
Who's our new mayor as of yesterday. The tweet handle is Order of the Women Who Give No Fucks. At W Who Give No Fucks. To she who dared to utter the F word. To a her story maker. To our first woman mayor. To a woman of color. To the most qualified candidate. Congratulations. And all this makes me want to do is, I mean, so happy that we have this mayor, and I want to look up some evidence of whenever she said fuck, because it'll make me so happy.
And then I want the t-shirt and the mug. That's fantastic. And we have a new mayor as well. Our new mayor is Amarjeet Sohi, and I'm so happy and thrilled and proud and full of glee for a couple of the, let's just say 50% of a dime candidate lost, and we're lucky. Calgary and Edmonton, we got good mayors, man. Good mayors.
Good mayors that represent our city.
Exactly. They represent certain parts of our city that are underrepresented, and that's great. So.
And Jody has already come out as a real arts supporter, which is a good thing.
Oh, Amarjeet is huge arts supporter. If you go down his Twitter, he has posted pictures of him in like his high school musicals. Like, it's awesome.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. They're adorable. Like, this is fantastic. Way back. But yeah, he's like a huge arts supporter. So, that's good for our corner for sure. Oh, should I tell you about my little mini phone thing that happened?
Yes, please.
Oh, murdered.
We've been talking about how we've been getting more and more of these scam phone calls telling us lately that we have tax evasion, or that there's a package been arrived at the border guards with our name on it and it's illegal or something. We've been getting more and more and more. And lately I've been answering, like, I've been going, okay, I press one. And as soon as they go hello, I go, hi, is there a problem? And then they hang up on me. So they're never trying to scam me anymore. As soon as I click through, yes, I want to talk to you, they hang up on me.
I wonder if maybe your number is now flagged on some of their things.
Maybe. Because of our episode, David Frank, what happened? So Steffi got a call yesterday or the day before.
No, this was a couple weeks ago. Oh. Or maybe last week. Time doesn't mean anything for me, but it was not yesterday and it was not the day before. It was further beyond that. I've got an app on my phone that can tape calls. And by the time I get through it, though, because you do have to jump through hoops now, right? You can't just answer. It'll say press one, right? Yeah. So by the minute that like, even the freaking taped hello, you're blah, 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 is so, like, it's the same one all the time.
Yeah.
So you know you're getting the same company, for lack of a better word. Anyway, I try and sign it in so that by the time I press one, it's recording. But I never quite get it right. And sometimes it makes a clicky sound. And so the guy usually hangs up. But this time I thought I got it all, but I didn't. I guess I didn't do it right. But anyway, so it got through and the guy said, hello, blah, blah, blah. And I said, yeah. And I tried this time to play it just really cool instead of I've tried taking on personas and whatnot.
Yeah,
and they're
too
onto that, right? Yeah. So this time I just said, oh, hi. I'm a little concerned. Your thing said that there's some there's a federal warrant out for my arrest. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? And he said, yes, I just want to confirm your identity. So there's no identity theft or fraud going on here. And I said, oh, no, I understand. Yes, please. He goes, can I have your name? So I gave him my middle name and my mom's maiden name. And then I said, could I have your name just so that I have some reference for this? Because, you know, it's a little worrisome. And he said, yeah, for sure. And his name was Adesh Ghosh or something. I couldn't quite. So I said, can you spell that for me? And he spelled it. I said, thank you. And he said, can you spell yours for me? So I did. And he goes, can you go slower? And I said, sure. So I spelled it out real slow. He said, can you give me the postal code of where you're from? So I made one up. I know in Saskatchewan, it's S7 because from my sister. So I gave him my sister's postal code, just inverted or something, like just a little bit different. And he's like, okay, just give me a moment here. So, you know, he's looking at my name to see if it matches my postal code. Of course,
yeah, exactly.
He's like, he comes back, goes, okay, thank you very much. Can you just give me your birthday to confirm? I need one more piece. And so I made up a birthday. He's like, okay. Oh my God. So, he said something about, I said, so what am I charged for? He said, well, there are multiple charges here. We'll begin at I just want you to know that there is cooperate now, they'll be all waived. I said, I want to know the charges. Like I said, I got to write these down. I got a pen ready. I'm ready to go. Like, I want to know from the first one. He said, well, we don't have to go through all of them. Just know that they're all there and you've been flagged. And when your name comes up, this is what comes up. If you're planning on traveling, this is going to, I said, but what are they? Like, I need to know what the charges are. And he said, well, I'm not willing to go into that yet. And I said, okay, you're being and then he clicked off. I was about to say, you're being taped, but and he clicked off. So I got a little far. But I mean, the comedy was he was being super, super official about making sure I was who I say I am. I think I was born in 19. I was really young, 1983 or something like that. Anyway, but I was just like smiling, going, wow, you guys, like, holy shit. I mean, I guess it obviously still works because they're still doing it. Say bye-bye.
I think next time I'm going to try your old lady trick.
But I wasted a good 5 minutes with that.
What was her name again? Do you remember?
I don't remember. I was just, what? What are you saying? Just your oven's on. Why is your oven on, honey?
Anyway, so, well, yeah, we'll just keep trying. Part of me wants to go buy one of those, you know, oldie-timey digital recorders so that I can put my phone on speaker and then just not have to worry about an app getting it or not. Just press record on my little tape player.
I know. We're the only two who want them. Why don't they talk to us? What's wrong with us? Why don't they
want to be scammed?
Why don't they want to scam me?
We had a lovely review that I noticed on Pod Status the other day from someone who said, these... I hate scams, but these two women share my joy in scamming the scammers. So that's what I want to do. I want a chance to scam them back. But
I know. And you've proven to be very adept at that. So you have, I think you are you go firsty pants.
I'm up. I want to tell you my sources. I used Wikipedia, Bloomberg Businessweek, Washington Post, Mental Floss, a site called A Little Bit Human, and then Swindled podcast, which we quite like.
Oh, we love him. This concerned citizen from Swindled. Citizen. I used him too.
The Indicator from Planet Money, Cautionary Tales, Hyper Focus, and then this one I just discovered. It's called Crash Bang Wallop. And these two fellas are so hilarious. Two British gents from the UK, I think, anyway, but they're hilarious. So at least go back and listen to something from Crash Bang Wallop just to get the joy of them.
Yeah. I wrote it down.
So this scam that I'm going to tell you, Stephanie, is it's very different in that it's not so much a scam as it is a fiasco.
Oh, cool.
But the people involved felt scammed. How's that? Well, I've told unintentional scams before.
Yep.
And this one is in that vein. So I would like to tell you about the 349 incident.
Okay.
This happened in the Philippines
in
1992. And in 1992, the Philippines is a poor country. Mm-hmm. What they were known for is in the entire world, they were the 12th highest consumer of soda pops.
Really? What an interesting, funny thing to be 12th best of.
12th highest consumer of soda pops. And you remember back in the day, there was the Coke and Pepsi wars. What's better? What's what?
Yeah. Blind Coke taste tests, all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. In 1992, Coke had 75% of the share of fizzy drink sales in the Philippines. And Pepsi only had 17%. Pepsi's like, we need to get more established in the Philippines. We need to get in more of the market share of fizzy drink sales.
Because capitalism and greed.
So they introduce sort of a lottery thing. And I remember growing up with these in Canada as well, where you could take the bottle cap off of a bottle and look underneath. Mm-hmm. And there was either a little rubber thing that mm-hmm. you pulled out mm-hmm. or it was written right on the bottle cap. It would say, you know, you win another free Pepsi or you win a new car.
I go back to this. I remember back to before it was rubber, it was cork. Like that's, I remember those even. That was, and then when they turned to rubber, we remember going, how do we peel these out? It's so hard. But yeah.
So Pepsi introduced this sort of bottle cap lottery in the Philippines in 1992. They called it Pepsi Number Fever. And the way it worked was that for this particular time, for this 4 month period or whatever in 1992, they would print numbers on the inside of every bottle cap from 1 to 999. And you buy a Pepsi, you look at your winning number, and then you watch the news. And if you remember how they used to draw the lotto on the news, even in Alberta here, right? The lotto number used to come up on the news. Yeah. So if you watched ABS-CBN News Channel 2 in Manila, they would give you the winning number for that day. Okay. Right. And so there was a bunch of winners. Most of them were like, you win this many pesos, which was the equivalent of about $5 American at the time, right?
So, I'd be happy to win $5 at a pop with a pop can.
Right.
Like, you know?
Pepsi put aside $2 million budget for this contest. And there were some grand prizes of 1 million Filipino pesos.
Okay, so how much is that?
At the time, it was the equivalent of $40,000. $40,000 American. Ton. It's a ton.
To win that now would be awesome from a bottle cap,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Like, and reading everything I've read, everything I've listened to, they call it life-changing. Like, that's at the time, was a life-changing amount of money.
Okay, so I'd switch to Pepsi.
Yeah.
So that's a good marketing.
People are buying Pepsi in the hopes that they will turn over what they call them crowns. The crown, the lid.
Oh, well, they turn like over crowns, the crown. Don't they?
Yeah.
Jughead crowns. I don't remember.
Jughead crowns. They turn over the crown and they'd look for their number. And there was lots of winners. There was actually 17 grand prize winners of $40,000 American. So 17 winners of 1 million pesos.
Right.
Was the equivalent of $680,000 American. So that was within their $2 million budget. They were still able to give away 17 grand prizes amongst all these other little ones. And there was the most hilarious commercials for them. I watched a bunch of them online. And it's like the same two characters, this nurse and this doctor. And the doctor's like about to cut in and do surgery. And the nurse walks in and goes, doctor, have you heard about the new Pepsi Number Fever? What's that? Well, you look under the crown and you could win $1 million. What? I want that. And then he leaves surgery and all the staff's going, wait, we got this body. And then the patient sits up and goes, Pepsi Number Fever, and runs off the table and runs after. And
his entrails are just following him. And some lady's picking up his intestines and shoving them back as he's running across the street.
Oh, my God, that would have been great. Well, there's a whole series of these commercials. So every time you see a commercial, it's the same doctor and nurse doing something. Ambulance chasing only because they want a ride to get to buying a Pepsi.
What a great gig to get that, hey? What a great gig.
Oh, totally.
Oh, man, you have a whole little mini series.
Exactly. It's one of the commercials. Because they always release the numbers on the news on Channel 2 every night, there was this lady that was always the woman that said, tomorrow's winning number is blah.
Right.
So one of the commercials has her in the studio going, tomorrow's winning number, and then the ambulance crashes through the studio and the doctor and nurse pop out and they go, stop, cut. I'll tell you what tomorrow's winning number is. Tomorrow's winning number is under one of these caps and there's thousands of them out there and they're all winners and you haven't found them yet. Get out there, buy Pepsi, whatever.
Wow, right? So it's exciting.
Tons and tons of commercials. People bought Pepsi like you wouldn't believe.
I bet.
Wow. 40% more people were buying Pepsi than they were beforehand. So I should
and
say
Coke,
that again,
all the Coke guys are sitting around the table just going, oh, rickum, shum, shum, shum. Jones, get in here. You're fired.
And I won't even get into that because there is like all this Coke backstory about how they reacted to all this, but it's too much. So in this 5 month period or whatever, they raised their image 40% in the Philippines and they gave away a shit ton of money, $680,000 American dollars right. So far. Right. And they went, this is going really, really good. We're going to extend it for 5 more weeks, okay. Is what they thought. So this is the way it worked. They would say, we're picking this winning number, 3, and this winning number, 217, and this winning number, 809. We're only going to print 2 of those each because they're going to be grand prize winners. And they'll say 679, and then they'll have a 7-digit security code underneath it. So these are the ones we're going to print. There's only 2 of these. There's only 2 of these. There's only 2 of these. And they're in a vault, and they're in Pepsi Company Corporation vault lock and seal.
Okay.
Then every other number printed can't be those numbers because they're the winners. So they're going to release them every once in a while. So every week they would go, okay, now we'll release the 2 number 3 winners. And now we'll release the 2 number 674 winners.
So this is making me think of your last scam where the guy's going, I'm going to get the algorithm and I'm going to sneak in with a,
yeah.
And I'm going to put it in there. And
so they had chosen some numbers that were million peso winners.
Okay.
And they kept them away from everything else and they let them out and put them into bottles when they chose as part of this campaign.
All right.
Lots of other numbers would go out, but they'd be $5 winners or yeah. Whatever. On May 25th, 1992, the winning number is announced, and it's 349.
Okay.
And there's one woman going, my husband can quit his rickshaw driving job.
Oh.
My 4 kids can afford to go to college. Like she's telling her kids, you get to go to college and
oh.
All this stuff. And they live like in a tin shack, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because they just won 1 million Filipino pesos.
Yeah.
Steffi. So did 468,000 other people.
Oh, no.
468,000 people had a winning bottle cap with 349 on it.
Whoopsie.
So what they think happened.
Shit.
What they think happened is that when the thing was running, when the original promotion was running, they said, don't print 349. That's one of our winning numbers.
Yeah.
We'll put it with its serial number and we'll put it in the vault and then we'll release it when we're ready.
Yeah.
When they decided to extend their competition by 5 weeks, apparently,
okay.
Somebody missed that memo and went ahead and printed 349.
Maybe when they saw the memo and it went, don't print 329, they went, oh, it says do print 349.
349. Well, what they say is it's a computer glitch. This is what they're saying. So 468,000 people think that they've won 1 million pesos. And there had been precedent. Like we'd already met 17 different winners on the news when they had won their $1 million and we'd seen their cap.
Right,
so people knew it was real that you could actually win $1 million. 17 people had already won $1 million.
And there's 450 million lawsuits for when they say we didn't mean that.
Oh, wait. Just wait for
it. Okay. Oh, good.
So all of a sudden, like the Pepsi company people in the Philippines are calling head office or whatever, going, why are there so many people at the gates looking for their money? Pepsi Corporation has this big 3 o'clock in the morning meeting.
Oh, no.
Everyone had to get up and go to a boardroom at 3 o'clock
ring,
in the morning.
Ring,
and
ring,
go,
ring.
What
ring.
The fuck happened? And what they said to people is, it's a computer glitch. It shouldn't have printed 349. There are 2 printed 349 that have the 7-digit security serial number. The other ones that were printed don't have that.
Ah.
They're not winners.
Okay. So there's proof. Okay. A kind of an explanation.
In terms of our podcast, Scam Time, 468,000 people were feeling scammed.
Well, yeah.
You didn't win. No, that's not a winning cap. But it just said on TV the winning's 349. I have a cap that says 349. And they were told it was a computer glitch and they weren't getting paid out. Some people had 35 caps because they were so invested in this contest that they're given Pepsi to their kids, left, right, and center, breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Nursing, here, slap a nipple on this bottle of Pepsi. There you go, genius. Got to use this stuff up.
So, except you wouldn't have to burp your baby. It would just come like that. So some people had like 35 winning bottle caps and were entitled or believed they were entitled to 35 million pesos. Anyway, so Pepsi says, no, it's a glitch. And what they do is they decide we're going to give everybody who thinks they won the equivalent of $18 American as a sorry we fucked up kind of goodwill gesture. So I think that was 50 pesos. I can't remember what the numbers are, but what you could accept if you wanted to was $18 in American money as a sorry, please get lost.
Right.
And many, many people did take that.
Better than nothing.
But
I
a whole bunch of people sued them.
Yeah.
And for the following year, Steffi, there was protests.
God.
And unbelievable protests and riots outside Pepsi buildings and government buildings in big cities in Philippines, like Manila, etc. People died, Steffi. They were tipping over Pepsi trucks. 37 different Pepsi trucks were either tipped over or burned or destroyed or vandalized. They were throwing homemade bombs. They were throwing grenades. One processor threw a grenade into a bottling plant and three workers died in that explosion.
It just goes to show you how desperate those people were and how much this meant and how stuck they all are. And
totally.
Oh, that's so sad.
One guy threw a grenade and it bounced off of the truck he was aiming for, rolled and killed a teacher and her student.
Ah, jeez.
5-year-old kid and her teacher. Like,
that's tragedy.
Massive amounts of people. People got together. They called themselves the 349 Coalition. One guy quit his job so that he could work full-time on trying to get the money that people were owed for this, right?
Wow.
There's a story of one fellow who is a minister. He's a preacher, and he is dead set against it. When it came out, when the program started, the promotion started, he was like, no, this plays on our gambling. It's terrible. Let's not do it. It's a terrible idea. His own daughter won a cap with a million peso winner. And so he was at these protests going, but my daughter should have $1 million, right?
Yeah, 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 right.
So horrible riots, horrible deaths.
Yeah, blood on Pepsi's hands, man. I mean,
some people did take the $18. Other people didn't. They said, nope, we're going to sue. We're going to charge you for fraud. It's not our mistake. It's your mistake and you should be paying for it. There was people that were like, stock market futures players that were saying to people, wow, I'll buy your 349 Pepsi lid for $15.
Because if they win the lawsuit,
these people would have more. So
holy shit. It's just like it's multiplying on top of itself. Did anyone find the 349 with the serial number on it?
I don't think so. So there was 800,000 caps printed with 349.
Oh,
468 of them had been purchased and were winners. That's 468 people said, I have a winner. So some people maybe didn't check their cap, but I've read nowhere that the actual 349 with serial number caps were bought or found by anybody or tried to be claimed.
Wow.
Everyone trying to claim just said 349 without a serial number. In offering a 50 peso goodwill gesture,
yeah,
it still cost Pepsi $8.9 million to give those people something. And their original promotion was budgeted at $2 million.
Ooh.
So now they're paying $8.9 million. You know how much it would have cost them if they had to pay out 800,000 winners? $32 billion.
Oh, my God. See, billion is where my brain starts going, I can't picture, like, it's beyond my capacity of what that is. It's so big, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So all of these protests, all of these deaths, Pepsi even had to fly some of their officials out of the country, like extract them from the war on Pepsi to safety. Exactly. There were 698 court cases that were civil suits charging fraud and 5,200 criminal complaints of fraud.
Just the cost of that alone. God.
All of these cases went on for years. They didn't come to a conclusion until 2006, and nobody won anything.
Ah, shit.
Every single case that went forward that eventually did go to trial, which wasn't that many. There was that many complaints or suits, but they didn't all go to trials. And of the ones that did go to trial, none of them won. And in every single case, the court would say it didn't have the serial number.
I mean, at the end of the day, I get it. Especially if they'd seen other ones that did have it and we kind of precedent was set. Like, no, you guys know when they show it on, there's a serial number there. But still, it's heartbreaking.
Here's what I want to read exactly, because this gives us more precise numbers. About 22,000 people took legal action against PepsiCo. At least 689 civil suits, 5,200 criminal complaints. On June 24th, 1996, this is 4 years after it happened, a trial court awarded the plaintiffs in one of the lawsuits 10,000 pesos, which is the equivalent of about 380 American dollars, in moral damages. Three dissatisfied plaintiffs appealed, and on July 3rd, 2001, the court awarded these complainants 300,000 pesos each, about 570 US each, as well as asking Pepsi to pay their attorney fees. Pepsi appealed that decision.
Oh, come on, Pepsi.
And the suit would reach the Supreme Court, which in 2006, and I'm reading this verbatim off Wikipedia, ruled that Pepsi is not liable to pay the amounts printed on the crowns to their holders, nor is Pepsi liable for damages thereon, and that the issues surrounding the 349 incident have been laid to rest and must no longer be disturbed in this decision.
Wow.
Somebody tried to reach them just within this last year to sort of get a comment on it. Pepsi responded, in response to a request for comment on the events described in the story, Pepsi said it would be unable to verify them. Quote, these events took place almost 30 years ago, and none of the executives familiar with this program are at PepsiCo anymore. Hmm. And given that the Philippines is just emerging from one of the world's longest COVID lockdowns, we have been unable to access stored records on this matter. We deeply regret any pain and suffering our mistake caused the people of the Philippines. So it's not like they didn't say it wasn't their mistake.
Right.
It was, but it was a computer mistake. Nobody was ever named as the person at fault for it. So nobody was ever, you know, like, well, it was Johnny that put it in the computer and he shouldn't have. They never named a name. It was just computer
little
glitch.
Mistakes happen all the time, and some of them have bigger costs, and this one was a doozy.
Holy. In the end, one half of the Philippines population participated in the promotion.
Wow.
Their loss in Pepsi, how many soda sales they had, went down, but it eventually went up again. Obviously, they're still around. They weren't really hurt by it. Eventually, it cost Pepsi $20 million in total for physical brand equity and legal costs. All in all, 20 million.
So you wonder, like, the people who kept appealing and kept, they must have been, like, not the rickshaw drivers. They must have been people who had money to keep a suit going, or, because how do you pay for that?
Well, the guy who quit his job to be in the 349 coalition, there was one lady who had won, and she's quoted as saying, even if I die here in this protest rally, my ghost will come back to keep fighting Pepsi.
Oh, my God. They, you know, I guess once you get going at it too, the stakes were so high for all those guys. What they needed was, they needed a Frank Abagnale to kind of be able to forge the little number in underneath the ball. But it would have to have matched. It would have to have matched. And how would he know?
That's exactly.
Did Pepsi continue? Like, do the Philippines hate Pepsi now? Are they vilified, or do people still buy Pepsi products?
They're still buy Pepsi. No, I don't know what the ratio is to Coke.
Yeah.
But Pepsi has Pepsi, Mountain Dew, 7-Up, and Miranda.
Okay.
So they're drinking Pepsi. There's a couple of stories about women who are like, I have a store and I will not stock Pepsi because 30 years ago I won the thing and I didn't get my money, so I won't put them on the shelf. One of my favorite bits of information is that if they'd had to have paid out the 1 million pesos for 800,000 bottle caps, it would have been $32 billion, which was twice the national budget of the Philippines at the time.
Like, it's just impossible.
And all sorts of rumors run around. Somebody said it's Pepsi that's doing all the damage. They're wrecking their own trucks. They're throwing their own grenades in order to look like the victim. That was called as a hoax. Then somebody said, I wonder if it's Coke or the other fizzy drinks that are doing it. And that was called as a hoax. I did read a great story about one of the Coke executives backing one of the protesters and like, here's some more money, keep fighting them. Here's a megaphone, keep yelling, that kind of stuff, which was really great.
What do I know? I know nothing. I would imagine small gestures like that would happen all the time. But those bigger kind of conspiracy theories, I always ask, but who's gaining from that? Like, if you're blowing up your own trucks, how is that helping you?
Yeah, exactly.
Whose benefit? It just
exactly. Yeah. The final say in the matter that I'd like to read is one of the officials from Pepsi at the time said, it's a horribly unfortunate situation, but there was no attempt on Pepsi's part to deceive anybody.
Yeah.
Which is true.
You know, no wonder the security around that must be just like unimaginable.
Well, but based on Lotto Dude from last week, somebody can get in there. Somebody can futz with it, right?
Everything has an opening, right? They say that the minute the people who are chasing the hackers understand what the hackers are doing, the hackers are already 5 years ahead of them. Like, it has to be a computer glitch, because why would, unless it's some cartoon up in a tower going, I'm just going to mess with people. Nobody wins. Like, no one can scam anything from that. Like, nobody's pockets are lined.
No, exactly. So, yeah. And even if it was Joe Blow who misread the paper that said don't put in 349 and did, it's pretty classy, I think, that Pepsi didn't throw anybody under the bus.
You know, that's a really good point, because I just watched the episode one of Succession. Do you watch Succession?
No, you told me to. I haven't watched it yet.
Oh, it's so good. I did the third season just started. A friend of ours' dad is the star. Alan Cox's dad is the star.
Oh, nice.
Brian okay. Cox. Yeah. Yep. So it's awesome to watch him. He's just the worst. But anyway, that Succession, everyone's constantly throwing everyone else under the bus. Like, it's just, so my brain is right there. It's funny you say that, because yeah, it would have been really easy that for them to have a sacrificial lamb to say, yeah, he did it and he admits it, and they, you know, pay his family a few millions.
Exactly.
And he goes to jail for 5 years, you know.
Boy, you'd have to put him in witness protection and move him to another country, and oh man.
Yeah
But they could have done that. It's true. Anyway,
they could have.
Did it make sense what I meant about how they, like, they were keeping the printed ones in their possessions until it was the week that they wanted to release them, and then they would send them
totally.
To the bottling plant? Okay.
Totally. In my mind, this is, okay, can I tell you what I pictured in my mind?
Yeah.
They had the two bottle caps, and they were put each one in a separate suitcase that when you open it, it's that foam, but it's lined with purple velvet. And it's just got a little indent where it's sitting in there, and you close it, tick, 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 and it's got like six layers of like combinations and stuff to open it. And then they're put in one of those rooms where there's like laser beam kind of threads that people have to do gymnastics to get through. That's what I pictured.
And then the vault is shut, and it's like one of those gigantic wheels on the front of the door that you have to turn to get
totally in. Yeah. And you can only be like a guy dressed in black with ballet shoes to be able to get through to the door.
Ding, ding,
yeah,
ding,
yeah.
Ding, ding.
And then someone's digging a giant hole underneath it so that they have, like, yeah, no, that's totally what I pictured. And Bugs Bunny. What are the two?
Somebody comes in and they see him, like, writing 349. What's up, Doc? Am I in your vault? I must have taken a wrong turn at Albuquerque.
Big Acme thing comes poof.
This episode of Scam Time is brought to you by Alberta Association of Optometrists, proudly celebrating a century of caring for Albertans. It happens. Parents can easily miss their child's eye problems. Issues can occur in only one eye, making it difficult to notice. The earlier an eye health or vision problem is identified, the more likely it can be corrected. The ICI Learning Program provides an eye exam and free glasses, if needed, for kindergarten-aged children. 25% of kids begin first grade with an undiagnosed eye problem. To book your child's eye exam, please visit optometrists.ab.ca. The Alberta Association of Optometrists represents almost 800 doctors of optometry in over 80 communities across the province. Members are highly trained, regulated health professionals who provide primary eye health and vision care to Albertans. Learn more at optometrist.ab.ca.
All right, good to go.
Awesome. I'm just telling my son that he has to leave now if he's going to get to the dentist on time.
Good.
Because, you know, I'm mom still, even though they're driving there. That's still me. You know what the response is? I know, mom.
Oh, wait, it wasn't... I know, mother.
It was close. It was mom. With the extra, just, I know, mom.
Mine would be, I know, mother. And don't tell me you're never late for things. You always, every time I want you to be somewhere on time, you're always late.
Oh, I hate it when they get me. When they hoist me on my own petard. It's like, no. All right. So I'm going to tell you the story of Esther Reed.
Oh.
Da, 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 da. She's a lady.
You, Esther Reed, you brought her.
Yeah.
Cheap.
No, it's perfect. Perfection. My sources are Dateline, 48 Hours from 2017. Peter Van Zandt was the host of that one. He did all the interviewing. Of course, Swindled. Another podcast called The Ivy League Murders with Laura McDonald and Sarah Alcorn. They're these two really cool ladies who live like in... right close to Harvard and right close to all the Ivy League schools. And they do a podcast about the murders that happened there.
Wow.
It's really cool. Yeah. It's called the Ivy League Murders. It's fun because they're like, yeah, we talk about people who have it all and throw it all away. That's sort of their thing. And also our friend, Loïc Piadian.
Ah, Loïc Piadian.
Yeah, that one. So there you go. That's where I got all this stuff from. Yes. So this one interested me because it's like, I mean, I guess they all are a little bit, but it's sort of like the Russian doll scams within scams. And you got to keep doing it to cover yourself. What's amazing is how brilliant these people are at remembering the shit they say. Because I would be so bad at it.
You can't even remember the name of the old lady you played when that scam guy called you.
Totally. I'd just be like caught in a second. Just like, I'm going to become a criminal. Excuse me, ma'am. Like it would just be that. I'd be already in jail. Just can't. Oh my God. Okay. So this story starts off in a different place and time. So early morning, July 4th, 1999, there's a young woman named Brooke Henson, and she disappeared out of a beautiful, small, bucolic kind of whistle-stop town in South Carolina called Traveler's Rest. Even the name is like, this is, if you're moving through South Carolina and you need a rest, you stop there. And
what does bucolic mean? It sounds like, isn't that a plague? Oh, no, that's bubonic. Never mind.
Let's look up bucolic. Bucolic. I think it means lovely, pretty, beautiful. Relating to the pleasant aspects of the countryside and country life.
All right. I'm going to use that word three times today.
So I just picture this deep woods, South Carolina, driving through and going, oh, I need a Pepsi. I'm going to just stop here and get me a Pepsi and fill my car up and onward I go. And someone says, have a nice day now, and off you go. So Brooke Henson, one of the podcasts that I got this from, said that she was a typical small town girl, dropout, and had a really bad boyfriend. I thought, no, that's not typical. That's just her. Anyway,
no.
It wasn't uncommon for people to drop out early and start working on their family's farms and stuff. They were bored. There wasn't a lot to do, so they'd work in the town. I guess that was a pretty common thing there. So Brooke Henson did. She dropped out in grade 10. Nobody blinked too much about it. That's just what people did. She had this boyfriend who was 10 years her senior. His name was Ricky Sean Shirley.
What?
Ricky Sean Shirley. So
I thought you said rickshaw. Good old rickshaw.
Ricky Sean was bad news. He was 10 years her senior. He reminds me of the guy that can't let go of his youth, but it's starting to leave him. He's tattooed up to the ears.
Oh, yeah.
He's just the was the coolest guy in town and now is just getting older, you know, her mom and dad were like, you know, he's no good for you, hun. And she didn't listen. And that probably made her even want to date him even more. Like he's the bad guy.
Am I right then that she would be 15 and he would be 25?
She
or
was
16 and 26?
By this, she dropped out in 10th grade. I don't know when she started dating him. He was 10 years older than her. I think she was was in his 30s by then. They'd been together for a couple years and they were always arguing. It was a really, really not a great relationship. They fought. Doors were slamming. They were always leaving. She was always coming home crying. He was always coming back and saying, hey, babe, you know, you're mine and all this stuff. You know, I love you best. And it was just a bad relationship, but it was just the way things were kind of new. He had a record. He was known to the police. I'm not just being stereotyping him, right? He is this long haired kind of, he looked the part and he was. So if you were casting this,
okay.
Is like the guy who looks like it, that's exactly who he was. He's just not a good guy. And so July 4th, 1999 rolls around. Her mom and dad go into town to see the Allman Brothers to celebrate the new year. She thinks she's going to have this great party. She invites all her friends. It's all fun and good. And they're all drinking beers and having their good time. And of course, there are probably some drugs involved. And Ricky starts getting a little bit abusive and yelly. And she starts getting yelly. And they have a huge fight. And oh, no, the drama. But no one blinks because it's like that's how they always are. It's just drama, drama. So 2 o'clock in the morning, her mom and dad come home. She's sitting on the front porch crying. They're like, what's wrong? Oh, Ricky and I had a fight. I think I want to break up with him, but I'm scared too. And he's staying over at their house. So he's in the house sleeping, actually. And she's out there crying and doesn't know what to do. And she goes, I got to get some cigarettes. One of the podcasts that I can't remember which one it was. Anyway, kept reinforcing the fact that she smoked Marlboro cigarettes. They kept saying it over and over again. I thought it was hilarious because I thought, okay, I've got it. I'm going to remember that. Never came back again. But anyway.
Never came back.
No. But apparently she smoked Marlboros and she had to go. She was like to her mom, I'm just going to go to the store and get a pack of smokes. I got to go get a pack of smokes. So she, her mom's like, I guess her mom actually said, this is not a good idea. It's 2 a.m. And her dad thought, I'm going to just follow her in. And she kind of gave him the side eye and she went into town and he regrets to this day that he didn't follow her in because he thought, you know what, we just got to give her space. She's upset. If I follow her in, she's just going to get mad. She was never seen again. She disappeared off the face of the earth. Never saw her again. Ricky Sean Shirley became a person of interest, of course, but he was there. They can't figure out a timeline. So he kind of falls out.
He was in the house sleeping.
They think.
And there's proof.
She also wrote a note that said, if you love me, you can follow me. Or if you care about me, follow me. That girlfriend thing is, you know, like, yeah, you know, I know. It's just ouch, ouch, ouch. He didn't follow her. Sad. Very, very, very tragic. It's the worst thing that ever happened in that town to that point. And it's never been solved. So that's the end of that story. So in 1999, the same year, another woman went missing and her name was Esther Reed. Now, Esther Reed and Brooke Henson's paths are going to cross in the future, which is why it was important to learn about Brooke Henson. So let's talk a little bit about Esther Reed and who she was. Who was Esther, you ask? Well, Esther was a girl who was born in Townsend, Montana.
Is it bucolic there?
I don't think it is as bucolic. I think it's maybe just buke, but but I guess it was another kind. She had a very sort of similar life, except for that she had like 8 siblings. She was the youngest of 8 siblings. Her mom had been married a few times, so a lot of them were sort of half siblings. But she had a really happy childhood, apparently. But one of her sisters said from when she was little, she hated her name. It was Esther Elizabeth Reed, and she hated her name. She wanted to be someone else from a little age, I guess. So that's just kind of interesting because we all play with names, I think, when we're younger. But she hated Esther. And she even said later, I hated that name so much I had no attachment to it. It was fine for me to not to be called that. Her brother also said that she wanted to be a lawyer from a really young age. She was always playing lawyer and being wanting to be a lawyer. So she's a really smart, smart kid. And I guess she was like, who wants to play lawyer? No friends. No
Cricket.
More friends.
Cricket. At least can I bang the gavel? No. Okay, I'm out.
Okay, you get to be judge next time, okay?
I want the briefcase this time. No.
No. So she said she was a really happy kid when she was younger. And the 48 Hours episode has them showing her pictures of when she was a little kid, and she starts to cry and she's like, why, what kind of feelings are these bringing up? And she said, no, I was a happy kid. I don't know what happened. I mourn what happened to me because I had a great childhood up until like she was 11 or so. Anyway, she was super smart, brilliant kid, but super bored. She was, you know, again, in a small town school, there was not a lot of things to do. And she got really bored. She would play chess with her brother, I guess, and just nail him every time. He said she was a brilliant chess player and that she was always thinking 4 or 5 moves ahead. She was this great strategist and a great problem solver. And so super freaking bored in high school, just like Yawnsville. So she drops out.
Sure.
Because she's just super bored. And her mom divorced her 5th husband and moved to Seattle. And Esther was, you know, thinking, well, maybe I can get a new start in Seattle with my mom. So she moves to Seattle to live with her mom, gets back into school. She loves her mom. Her and her mom have a great relationship. She gets back into high school, bored out of her tree again, drops out again. And then her world starts to dissolve and the spiral starts to happen. The out of control spiral starts to happen. Her mom dies of cancer in 1998. Aww. And that is who is keeping her together. Like she says that she has had a really toxic relationship with her brothers and sisters. Nobody went into the story of what that was. In fact, her sisters seemed to want to find her for many, many years. They thought she disappeared. They actually thought she might have been one of the victims of the Green River Killer, I guess, in Seattle, who was still active at the time.
Right.
And there was a body that was found that they couldn't really identify, and they thought it might be her because after her mom died, Esther disappeared. Poof, kapow, gone. And so no one knew where she was, and their family was really upset. She says that when her mom died, her whole world crashed. She didn't want to go back home. She didn't know what to do with her life. So she decided to get the hell out of Dodge, and she went underground. She told her sister she'd keep in touch for a while, and I guess she did for a while.
How old is she at this point?
I think she must have been still a teenager. 1999. She was born in 1978. So 20-something,
19 or 20.
Just before, I guess, she went to Seattle, she had stolen her sister's purse and taken a whole lot of money and written a bunch of checks. And her sister got really mad at her and everything. And then when she was in Seattle before her mom died, after she dropped out of high school, she had a job and she had stolen a coworker's purse. And she got caught for that, so she had a record.
Yeah.
Of course, she was sorry. I just don't know what to do with my life anymore, blah, blah, blah. So that was one of the things that was stopping her from going back to school and all that stuff, because she now had this record at that. So she decided her mom was fine. Her mom had passed on, and so she's going, I'm getting out of here. I'm diving under. I'm going underground. I don't feel like fighting anything. I just want to start as a new person. So she did what a lot of people, I think, kind of want to do at that point in their lives. They want to start over. They want to clear the slate. They want to be someone else. You know, she's at that place in her life. So she does. So she decides she's going to get a new persona, and she gets one of her ex-boyfriend's sister's name, who is Natalie Fisher. And she knows enough about Natalie Fisher to do all the things that people who steal identities do. She opened up accounts and stuff under her. And she went underground as that. Now, a little bit about how she looked. It's hard to describe this without feeling like you're saying something inappropriate, but this is how she was described. She was described as a dumpy, unremarkable teenager. She had a weight problem for a long time. That was her interpretation of herself as well. She'd look at pictures of herself and say, I hate myself. I hate myself. Well, she's very unremarkable. And, you know, it's hard to talk about that because who cares? But people care.
At the time, that was driving her. That was part of her motivation, is I feel useless and dumb.
Yeah, I'm ugly. No one
likes
me.
She's calling herself that.
Yeah, she is. But a lot of people are calling her that too. Like, oh yeah, well, she was nothing to write home about. She was, you know, this and that and this and that. But her drama teacher in high school had said she was the kind of girl who you wouldn't notice unless you took great pains to reach out to. She kept quiet. She kept silent. She hid in herself. But he said she was a really gifted speaker. She was very quiet, but she was a really gifted speaker. So he kind of encouraged that. She loved to debate. So she kind of got a little bit of notoriety that way.
Yeah, because she wants to be a lawyer.
Yeah, she's really freaking smart. And I think part of why she's quiet is because everyone around her, she thinks is boring. And they're interested in the things she just doesn't give a shit about, you know?
Right.
But after she became Natalie Fisher, after her mom died and she got this new persona, she had plans of who she wanted to be. She wanted to be a high-powered, super successful lawyer. So she's now underground on the lam. She's got a car. She's literally crossing California and driving all over the place, going from cheap hotel to cheap hotel. And the way she's doing it is she's using Natalie Fisher's money, like base credit, and she's losing weight like crazy. And she gets breast implants, and she suddenly transforms herself into kind of this little knockout. She does all this. People go, well, how did she pay for all that? Scam within a scam. This is the tiniest part of her scam. What she would do is she'd go to sales at JCPenney, was her main place, buy something really cheap. She could forge, like our old friend Frank Abagnale again, she could forge the receipts really, really well. She'd bring them back and get, you know, three times the money back for it and pocket the cash. Now, to me, that sounds like, okay, so you could probably make a couple $100 doing that and whatever, fill your car up with gas. But she did that for tens of thousands of dollars over a couple of years.
Wow.
And in the 90s, like now there's no way, like all those numbers would say, no, this was on sale. You're not getting it. You know, like you couldn't do that with a computer.
Yeah, but back then
you still could.
The receipt says you bought it for $5,000, even though it's a $50 scarf.
That's right. And so she did that at all. I think that's one of the reasons why she was going to town to town to town, because she just keep going to JCPenney's. And she was making some, she was making some good money, I guess. She was forging all her own documents. So she had talent in doing all of that. Basically what she really does want to go back to school. Like she legit wants to go back to school, but she can't because she's a grade 10 dropout. So what does she have to do? She has to get her GEDs. She gets them under Natalie Fisher. She nails it. She doesn't study. She gets her, like, she's now a high school grad with the toppest marks of the GED that you can get.
And at this point, Natalie Fisher has no clue. Like, it hasn't gotten back to Natalie Fisher? Okay.
Not yet. So our Esther Natalie Fisher ends up in, where did she end up in? California somewhere.
Somewhere bucolic.
Yeah, somewhere bucolic with rickshaws.
I promised myself I'd use the word three times today, and I think I've done it now.
Yay! She ends up at this place. She finds a summer kind of debate camp, a summer debate program, and she meets college students and stuff. And she's hot now, right? She's fitting right in, and she's being who she wants to be. And people are giving her the attention that she, the kind of attention she wants and, you know, needs. And she feels like somebody now. And she's so good on this debate summer program that the guy, John Brushke, not that it matters who his name is, was so impressed by her that he's like, you've got to join the debate team at Cal State in Fullerton. We'll get into Cal State. You're on the debate team. You're going to be a superstar. And so she does. She's like, great. But the real Natalie Fisher starts getting bills, $400 for this. And yeah, for phone bills and stuff like that. Yeah. And you get to see her on the 48 hours. It's pretty cool. She's kind of weirdly impressed. She's like, you know, she's really smart. I guess she wasn't super angry. She was like, wow. Like she was kind of impressed. Like, wow.
And Natalie Fisher's brother was Esther's ex-boyfriend. And was he involved in helping Esther have this? No. Nope.
Okay. He's not even a thing. He's not even a drip in the ocean.
He's a important person. He's just not part of the scam.
He's so not worth anybody's time. She broke up with him. He's over. He's in the back room doing whatever. Anyway, Natalie's like, ding, ding. I'm freezing all my accounts. No more. So Esther's like, oh, foiled. Oh no, I'm just finally, my dreams are coming true. I'm going to go to Cal State. I'm going to be on the debating team and wreck them, shuck them. So she changes her name to Natalie Bowman, and she says to the people at the admissions, and throughout all my sources, there's a timeline here that sometimes gets a little jiggy of when things happened.
Yeah,
and
that always
how.
Happens every time. Yeah. I look at the scab. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, wait a minute, they said this and they said that. So, but generally speaking, she changed her name again. And people are saying, she's always got money. She's got money, 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 always cash. And so they're like, how are you making all this money? And she's like, well, I'm a chess champion. I play international chess tournaments and I win about 10 grand a pop. Back then, I would, like, even 2 years ago, I would have gone, you can do that. But since The Queen's Gambit, did you watch that on Netflix?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you go, oh, it's a whole thing, a world I had no. So yep. She says that she's part of that. And she is, I guess, a really good chess player. But when people say, great, let's play, she always has a reason why she can't or won't.
Right. Right.
Because maybe she's a good player, but not that good. Like, yeah. But anyway, that's where she says she's getting all her JCPenney money from, is that. And people believe her because it's a university and that's a real thing. And they have no reason not to believe her. So they go like, great, she's brilliant. I believe it. In her SATs, she gets 1400. I don't know much about what the SATs are, but apparently that's unbelievable. And I guess it's out of 1600. And back in the day, she got like that. She never prepped. She didn't do anything. She just took it. You know, back to our Varsity Blues scandal, it's the opposite. Like, they were paying people to go in and write those tests.
Right.
She went and say they were those guys. She went in as not herself and nails it. Like, boom.
Right.
So it's almost the opposite. She's just so good at it. Oh, and she says that her new name, she needs to have this new name because she's a victim of abuse and she has a stalker and she can't use her real name because he'll find her and she's afraid for her life. And they believe it.
She is smart.
Now, she's at Cal State for a while. She's doing really great, but she's like, this isn't Ivy League. It's not good enough for me. I'm better than this. I'm smarter than this. I deserve more. You know, this entitled thing, right? Just, I get to have this because I'm smart enough and it doesn't matter. So she gets one of her profs, Dr. Mitch Avila, to write a letter of recommendation to get into Harvard. Harvard Extension, which isn't Harvard proper, but it's still pretty hard to get into, I guess. I need you to write it under another different name because I'm really scared and I blah, 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 blah.
My stalker.
Yeah, my stalker. And she realizes... I need to have a persona that I actually have a social security number for. I need to have something that's more legit than these names because it's too easy to get busted. So she gets into databases and stuff and goes, a missing person. That would be good because there's still stuff. Guess who?
Oh, no.
Guess who she finds? Brooke Henson.
Brooke Henson.
They're the same age. There's enough. They're both dropouts. There's enough kind of stuff that is that works for her. So she takes on Brooke Henson's Brooke Henson's kind of perfect fit of a persona. Here's the thing. She's such a brilliant con artist and a manipulator. It's hard to believe, but she says she just, now that she knew she could do it, and now that she knew that she was on the right track, she didn't want to be in contact with her family anymore because of this, all these horrible relationships, which no one seems to be able to verify. But anyway, she says she wants to be Brooke Henson for the rest of her life. She decides that from now on, if she's going to do everything on the up and up with this new persona, because this person's been missing for a long time now. No one's found that she thinks.
Besides the name, she's going to turn herself straight.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. So she gets into Harvard, of course. She moves to New York City. She starts, she says she's going straight, but she gets over $100,000 of student loans by doing various, I don't know, things. She gets a bunch of student loans. She gets an apartment right close to Central Park. Like, she's got enough money to do that. No one can do that.
No.
Anyway, she's taking criminology and psychology. And in the 48 Hours episode, he goes, criminology and psychology, isn't that perfect for a con artist? And she just looks at him straight and goes, isn't it perfect for a lawyer? And it's like, oh, she's freaking good. Like, she makes him look kind of dumb.
Yep.
You know, she's at Harvard Extension, which is still good, but not good enough for her. She thinks, I think I can do Columbia. I think I can do an actual Ivy League school. I'm going to do it. She applies to Columbia. She gets in easily, and she's there at Columbia University for 2 years. She's living close to Central Park. She's got all this money, all this cash again. She says she's doing it on the up and up, studying psychology. She has a 3.22 grade point average. She said, after I was Brooke, I never borrowed a penny that I didn't intend to pay back. And they show her notebook and she's adding up all her debts and she's going, this is what I owe. And she's kind of going, I'm going to pay it all back because I'm going to be a brilliant lawyer and I'm going to be unstoppable. And all of her friends say that she's amazing, that she's still winning money playing chess, all that stuff. While she's doing this, she's dating, like, literally the word was dozens of people. I think that means mostly online, like mostly text. So she's dating dozens and dozens of West Point grads and people at West Point and all these soldier students and stuff. They find tons of text streams after this is all over on that she's, you know, she's even getting money wired from her from Germany. So she's not really doing it on the up and up like she kind of says that she wanted to. And all these guys from West Point, she's really grilling them. Like, she's saying, they have one text stream. He says, oh, we just had this exam where we had to make this battle plan or something. And she's like, can I see it? And there's all this record of her. And he's like, yeah, sure, I'll text it to you. And she just keeps grilling them about procedure, about all this stuff. So that's another thing that's sort of going on with her. So here's the irony of ironies. Now that she's Brooke Henson and she's living her dream, karma kind of finally catches up with her. And so she's in New York City. Lots of people need students for nannies and sort of housekeepers. She applies for this housekeeping job in this rich, rich household. And he wants to hire her. Oh, no. He does a background check. Oh, no. Brooke Henson's a missing person.
Oh.
Oh, no. I know. So he thinks,
I found a missing person. Oh, no.
Like, he kind of thinks he's a big hero, right? Oh. So he, yeah, I know. He calls the cops. She has the same birthday, the same social security number. It's not like it's another Brooke Henson. He's right. Like, no, this is her. This has got to be her. NYPD Blue, NYPD Blue, the TV show.
Where she wants to play a lawyer.
Yeah. They're the coolest lawyers on that show in the 90s. It's the best. NYPD contact Esther and she gives them the story. She's so good that she has this abusive family back home in Whistle Stop or wherever it was.
You call it Whistle Stop? Traveler's Rest.
Yes, good for you. Yeah. As Brooke, she says, no, I don't want anything to do with those people. I'm trying to just get on with my life and get an education and I don't want to be bothered with them. And they kind of buy it. They're like, okay, well, we don't want to mess up a young person's life. So they kind of say, but we have to get in contact with South Carolina to say that we found you so we can get you off the missing persons list. Basically. So they call South Carolina. South Carolina's like, what the fuck, man? We've been looking for her for millions of years. It's the only bad thing that's ever happened here. And if we find her, like, we're not giving up on this. You have to question her. We have to find out more. I think it's because it's more of a anomaly for them. And for NYPD, it's like, okay, there's another one. You know, there's just it's New York City, for God's sake, right? So the NYPD's like, okay, okay, fine. We'll do some DNA, okay? We'll do some DNA. So they call her up and say, hey, you know, we just want to make sure we dot all the I's and cross all the T's. Can you come in tomorrow for a DNA test? She's like, sure. But you don't give a con artist like 24 hours of a like head start. So she's like, awesome. Yeah, no problem. No problem. Thanks. Click. Runs out, rents a U-Haul, grabs her shih tzus. That's all she has time for. Doesn't have time to pack anything, but she's smart enough
grabs
to take her
what?
Shih tzus. She has two dogs. Oh, they're two called dogs. Shih tzus. They're little
I thought
ones.
You said she grabbed her shit shoes. I'm like,
Yeah, and her shit shoes because she likes Louboutins, but they're too high. And she's on the run. So she doesn't want to be wearing 5-inch spike heels.
So she grabs just her wants shit shoes.
Her shit shoes because you can really move in those. She grabs her hairbrush. She grabs her toothbrush. She grabs her toothpaste. She grabs anything that she thinks they can find DNA on, which is.
Oh, my God.
Like, so smart. They needed samples, and she took them all, that she put it on a suitcase, grabbed her dogs, took off out the back door of cars, and she's gone. She's disappears. They can't find anything that has any DNA on it that they can use. There's no hair. There's no skin. I mean, I know now they probably could, but they couldn't find. They had nothing. She did a great job. But what they did find was tons and tons of paperwork and incriminating evidence. Like, they found bills under different people's names and things like that. And they found actually a birth certificate, I think, of Esther's actual birth certificate, I think, or a copy of it. They found things that she had forged. They found a lot of, because she's also has a lot of good record keeping skills because she has to keep track of all of her shit, right?
Yeah.
So they find all of this and they start working backwards from Brooke to Natalie to blah, blah, blah. They kind of work backwards to, oh, Esther, that's who you are. So now they know who she is. She's gone, but they know who she is now.
So suspenseful.
She becomes one of the top 10 people on the missing persons fugitive list. Like, Interpol, everyone. They're like, ding, 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 all these things. And it's like, they think, well, wow, that seems kind of aggressive. But they found all this evidence that she'd been dating these West Point guys, who are high military guys who one day may seat in big seats of power.
Who might have texted the blueprints of a submarine to her. Right.
Yeah, the Death Star. She's got all the plans to the fourth Death Star. Yeah, and so they're like, oh, no, she's a Mata Hari. But, you know, they think she could possibly be a spy. And, have you ever watched The Americans?
No.
So good. And if you watch that, you'll go, yeah, because all those spies use sex and they use dating and relationships to get their stuff. They don't sneak in and steal. They like,
no,
they're in for the long haul and they let you believe that they're your child's teacher. And then you give them information that you don't know because you trust them. And so they're thinking, well, maybe that was her game. Like, she's getting money from a West Point student in Germany. I think he was a West Point. Anyway, there's something not right there. So they're looking for her hard. And she's hiding really, really well. Yeah. So it turns out, I mean, she's not espionage.
No,
they don't. She's what she is she's a person who she's a sponge. She even says that she takes in everything and everything she wants to know about everything. And so they think it could be simply that she's dating someone and she's like, oh, well, text me what that is. I want to see it, because she's that curious and she's interested. And she also amasses information for the future so that because she's always trying to figure, because she's not really who she says she is. And she's looking for, like, that might be the direction of law that she wants to be in that kind of world. And so she's just amassing information because that's how her brain works. So that's kind of been debunked, but it was funny. That was immediately, they're like, oh, she's a spy. She's a spy. She's using her feminine wiles to get the Death Star. Crimes. Okay. Fast forward. She's on the run. She's managed to stay away for a while now. We're now at February 3rd in 2008. They figure they're following her phone and all this stuff, and they think she's in the Chicago area. A place called Tinley Park, Illinois, which is a little bit out of Chicago. Lane Bryant store, I guess it's a store for plus size ladies. It's a beautiful store. It's got great clothes. It opens up in the morning. It's an outdoor strip mall. A guy shows up at this Lane Bryant store in the morning and makes five women go into the back and lay down face down. And two of them are customers. And he's robbing this plus size woman's store. I don't know how much money he thinks he's going to get at 9 o'clock in the morning, but he's probably high on something and he's probably whacked out of his head. And He kills them all except for one. He shoots them all in the head. One of them moves at the last second and the bullet just grazes her and she lives. But so this parking lot, everything gets shut down immediately. I guess the police were like on it in seconds. It all happened really, really quickly. And so they are going around taking all the license plates of everybody in the parking lot. They're questioning everyone within a certain radius. They're doing what police guys do. So there's a Sleepy Inn motel and it's right across the street. So they're going there. They're knocking on all the doors. They're asking questions of everybody in the Sleepy Inn. They knock on guess whose door?
Oh my gosh.
Esther's staying there. And she doesn't know what's going on. I guess she was asleep. She woke up. Cop's like, can I see your ID? We're just checking out. This has happened. She's like, yeah, sure. She thinks that they're just ticking people off the box to make sure that that car wasn't, you know, they're just taking sort of attendance of who's been around. Did anyone see anything? So of course they put her stuff through and it of course sets off an alarm. They're like, oh, you know what? You might not have anything to do with this mass murder and this horrible tragedy, but you're on the wanted list. And she just starts to panic because they come back and they start asking questions. And she's like, they've got me. Fuck, they've got me. She's arrested. And she actually says, I'm who you think I am. I'm Esther Reed. You got me. I know there's part of you like, oh, she did almost made it. But, you know, it's like Frank Abagnale comes up on the 48 hours, even talk to him. And they say, what do you think she's living through? What is it like to do that? And he says, it's awful. You're under stress all the time. Every single day, you're checking everything and going back over things so that you don't blow your cover. He said, the movie makes it look romantic, but it's really not. No, it's not. Really hard work.
She's staying at a Sleepy Inn.
Yeah. And they say, you know, well, why couldn't she, you know, we always ask this too. Why couldn't you do it if you're that brilliant as yourself? Well, one of the things is, one of the psychologist people they were talking to said, well, for a personality type like that, that's not fun. That's work. The con is the fun. That's the enjoyment of it. They enjoy that. Even though it's hard, that's what's kind of driving them. Anyway, rewind just a bit. When they found out that they thought they had found Brooke Henson, the family, this is one thing I actually got to insert here, because it's really an awesome little story. They got, the family was like, what if it's her though? What if it's her? Oh my God, maybe they did find her. And they're like, they're reliving all of their trauma and stress. And one of the aunts said that her family had also split up. The dad had got like, you know, that kind of thing is horrifying for a family. That family fell apart. But the aunt said, you know what? I ask her these questions. I'll make 10 questions or 20 questions that no one but the real Brooke would know. Like, what is her brother's ex-best friend's nickname? What is her uncle who ran away and such, what is his name? What are the pets' names? Like all these questions that only she would know. She gets them almost all right. I don't know how, and that's a mystery. Like they're like, how? Some people think her debating skills got in so that she would be able to manipulate, like cops try to do to you to get answers out of you, that she could do back to them. And or she just did such a deep dive and she just learned as much as she could. And somehow there was enough online about this young woman back in 1990, whenever. That's another reason why the police believed her, why the NYPD went, oh, well, okay, she just wants to be left alone because she could answer these questions, which is kind of...
She knew his nickname was Bubba.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's kind of crazy that she was able to do that. But anyway... fast forward to now, she's in custody. She says, yes, I'm Esther Reed. Her family, the Reed family, is now going, oh my God, thank God. Why did you do this? And she kind of says, I don't know. She tells the interviewer that she has all these toxic relationships with them. Who knows? They didn't really get into that. At the same time, a lot of people have toxic relationships with their family and don't do what she did to get away.
Yes, right?
You know? Yeah. So she just says, this is an actual quote, I just wanted to go to college and have a family where I wasn't constantly plagued by toxic relationships that I can't make work.
Oh my God.
So do a lot of people. But she says that she's, you know, diagnosed with this personality disorder by some of the world's greatest experts. The interviewer goes, aren't you lying? God, you could be lying to me. You could be messing with me right now. She goes, I could be, but I have the papers. I have the receipts. And her lawyer's like, no, she's been diagnosed with this underlying psychological social anxiety disorder that is, that the symptoms are, you have phobias about everything, that everyone's trying to judge you, that everyone's trying to criticize you. And it's debilitating if you're who you are. But when you say you're someone else, you feel like you can circumnavigate it. I guess it's a thing. And she has it. So she's in a letter to her sister. And I'll just read. This is an exact quote that she wrote to her sister. Ever since I was a young kid, I've had urges of stealing. Most of the time I can overcome them, but as I got older, the things I took got bigger and the schemes I tried to pull got worse. When I was 14, I learned to lock myself in a little box. I had no idea how to unlock it. When I steal, I shut off all my feelings. It bothers me, but not like it should. Sitting in a jail cell will tell you there is a little bit more wrong with you than just saying no will fix. Something inside of me is different. I don't want to be the girl who let life pass me by because I was too afraid to live it. And her father, her actual father, said that she had called him and said, "Dad, I'm going to be doing some things that you don't approve of morally. I'm just letting you know that." And he never heard from her again. But she was convicted. She was at first given, like, I don't know, 47 years of a sentence. That's what it was going to be, which seems like, really, rapists and murderers don't get that much.
No.
But she was able to plead it down to like 51 months, which is about 4 years-ish that she spent. And then she was released on October 27th, 2011. So like 10 years ago now,
right,
she was released. So I went down the hole trying to find, like, what's she doing now? At the end of the 48 hours interview, just before she went into jail, she said, "When I come out, I may change my name legally and start over again and do it all with no BS. I'll start from scratch."
She did the 48 hours interview before she went into jail?
Yeah, it was just before. Like, she had been convicted and everything. This was a moment. She said, "I'm going to just say my piece. I'll say it to you guys. And then that's it. I'm never talking again."
Right.
And so she gave this interview and then she kind of disappeared again. She got out of jail in 2011. And there's nothing. She probably did do that, change her name. Frank Abagnale, they talked to him and he says, "I think she's probably has the potential to do a great deal of good because she's brilliant. And if she does come over to our side, you know, the door's there because we could use her, you know."
Yeah.
But she seems to have disappeared, or she's somebody else doing what she always wanted to do. But she's a felon, so I don't think she can be a lawyer. So who knows where or what happened in the end to her, but she was caught and she did serve some time. And the poor Brooke Henson's family never did get closure because they never did find a murderer. Ricky Sean, I guess, took his own life not long ago. He had been arrested a few more times for abusing two people. They didn't say if they were women or men. Who knows what happened? But yeah, so that is the story of Esther Reed. And there's lots online and stuff if you want to go watch, see her be interviewed. She's an interesting cat. There you go. That's our Esther.
It's terrible when I'm like, "Oh, a good woman scammer." Like, I don't know why.
I know.
I get pride.
And I mean, the one that I did with Mark about Anna Delvey, she was brilliant in that way too. But the thing about her was she was all about getting rich and living in with the 1%. And it was a little less, I had less empathy.
This one dropped out of school so that she could go to school.
Kinda. She just wanted, she's in her where she just wanted to get an education. She wanted to fulfill her potential. I guess, you know, when you think about it, she was so young when she started scamming. She was just a teenager. So, you know, I don't know. But anyway.
Oh, Esther.
Anyway. Esther.
That was a really good one.
I hope she's doing the right thing somewhere with her brains and making, you know, solving problems for other people's lives. That would
maybe
be
she's nice. A consultant on the Queen's Gambit.
Oh, maybe.
I've decided that's where she is now.
Okay. Awesome.
Okay, let's do two truths and a lie.
Okay, I'll go first.
Okay.
Okay, I gotta go remember two truths and a lie. Okay. My name is Stephanie Teresa Wolf. That's so obvious. I can't. That's the truth. Maybe you better go first.
Okay. Okay. In high school, I was on the cheerleading team, and we had two coaches, one of whose name was Mary. I was also a DJ on our high school radio station, which I think was WBEV, and my co-host was Darren, and I was on the speech and debate team in high school, and it was run by a man named Mr. Willard.
I'm going to say that the middle one, the DJ, is the lie.
No, it's the truth.
Ah, because of Darren. I was like, yeah, his name wasn't Darren.
Darren Winkert, I think. I don't remember. I was on the cheerleading team, and I was a DJ, but I was never on debate and speech.
Oh, cool. But is Mr. Willard a real name?
No, I made that up right now.
Oh, because that was I was like, oh, wow, that's good. That's good. I was going to go with that one, and I went, no, Mr. Willard came too easy. Okay, two truths and a lie. This is a hard one for me this week. I don't know why. My favorite pop is Grape Fanta. I love butterbeer, and I'm a Coke person.
Oh.
As opposed to Pepsi.
I think you are a Coke person, and I think you like Fanta, so I think loving butterbeer is the lie.
Nope, I hate Grape Fanta. I love butterbeer.
But you hate Grape Fanta. Where are you getting butterbeer? Like Harry Potter butterbeer?
Yeah, at Harry Potter World in Universal Studios. It's so good. I remember, here's my little butterbeer story. When we were in Universal Studios, Sean was littler and Nathan was bigger. And Nathan wanted to go on some of the bigger, more crazy rides that Sean was just not quite tall enough to go on. So when the dad and big boy would go on that, Sean and I would go to hang out or do something else. Well, there was one point during the day that Nathan wanted to go on this killer ride that would have made me sick even. And dad said, okay, I'll take Nate. I'll meet you guys back here. You and Sean can go. And I said to Sean, because we'd already had a butterbeer already and they're like $7 or $8, right? They're ridiculously expensive.
Yeah.
I said, hey, while they're going to do that, let's go get another butterbeer. So off we went. No one will know. No one will know. We get in line. Who's in front of us in the lineup? Nathan and Lauren, they were like, okay, let's just go get a butterbeer. They'll never know. They'll never know. So instead of going on the big, huge ride, they had taken off and gone, this is exactly the same thing. Let's go get a butterbeer. No one will ever know. So there's the whole family. No one ended up going on any ride. They were just like, how do we get another butterbeer without making mom mad or without making dad mad?
Oh my God.
Anyway, that's my butterbeer story.
Listeners, if you have any fun butterbeer stories, or if you want to tell us two truths and a lie and let us figure out which lie it is, we would love to play that game with you. So please send us two truths and a lie at thebroadgap@gmail.com. Thebroadgap@gmail.com. And let us guess what your lie is.
Speaking of the broad gap on Instagram, we are at the broad gap on Instagram. There's pictures and fun things of all the people that we've covered there. And on Twitter, we're at scam time. Nice and easy for that one. Please tweet us or check or join us on Instagram or whatever. And whatever podcast venue you listen to us through, venue, is that the word?
Yeah. Provider.
If it's Apple, if it's provider, whichever, please like, review and subscribe. That helps us out a whole pile, and we'd love it if you're enjoying it, just to take an extra second and just do that for us. We'd love that.
As always, we would like to thank the Alberta Podcast Network. Scam Time is a member of the Alberta Podcast Network, locally grown, community supported. Lots of amazing Alberta podcasts on that network, so have a look there.
And at the end of the day, who are the best listeners?
You are.
You are the good listener. Yeah. Who's a good listener?
You're a good listener.
Who's a good listener?
Yes, you are.
God, love you so much.
Yes, you
good. Are. Good.